Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Whether you call it football or soccer in your part of the world, Match of the Day Africa Top 10 is the podcast from the BBC World Service ranking the best African players.
This guy is recognised as the best in the world.
Teams.
Ball coming, turn, boom.
And the biggest moments in African football.
The whole world remembers that.
Remember that, yeah.
It's not just African fans.
Match of the Day Africa Top 10. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Brandt, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 12th of July, these are our main stories. Before attending a NATO summit, President Zelensky has told a crowd in Lithuania that the alliance will be strengthened if his country is allowed to join. Dozens of people have been arrested in Israel during protests against the government's decision to push ahead with curbs to the power of the judiciary. And there's fresh evidence of the security challenge facing Nigeria's new president. 800 people were killed in attacks last month. Also in this podcast, how a lake in Canada could help scientists who are trying to define a new geological era.
It's the rapidity and the magnitude of this change that has occurred only very recently, but has really knocked us into this potentially new epoch.
We start with Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky has told a crowd of thousands in the Lithuanian capital Vilnius that his country would make NATO stronger if it became a member. President Zelensky is in the city for a two-day NATO summit at which Ukraine's membership bid is one of the main items on the agenda. He described NATO's refusal to set a timetable for membership as absurd. The NATO chief, Jens Stoltenberg, has denied that the alliance has fudged the issue of Ukrainian membership. He said the position of the alliance was united, strong and positive.
There's never been a stronger message from NATO at any time, both when it comes to the political message on the path forward for membership and the concrete support from NATO allies, military support, but also the practical support on how to ensure full interoperability.
From the summit in Vilnius, here's our Europe editor, Katya Adler.
Slava Ukraine!
Glory to Ukraine, declared Volodymyr Zelensky, putting a brave face on his disappointment as he stopped at a pro-Ukraine rally in central Vilnius on his way to a NATO dinner. Earlier, he published a stinging tweet. NATO's uncertainty and weakness over his country's eventual membership of the alliance was absurd, he said. It would just encourage Russia to continue its terror. Hardly the show of unity NATO allies had hoped for as a clear message to Moscow, which is watching this summit closely. The truth, though, is that while NATO countries are united in supporting Ukraine with military and humanitarian aid for the short, medium and long term, and while they all say Ukraine belongs inside NATO eventually, the hows and whens divide them. The US and Germany are in the slowly camp, wary of the risk of coming into direct conflict with the nuclear power that is Russia. While the Baltic states, which neighbour Russia and fear they could be next if Moscow is victorious in Ukraine, think Kyiv's NATO membership should be fast-tracked as soon as there's a ceasefire. Kaja Kallas is the Prime Minister of Estonia.
I think we also owe it to the Ukrainians because they are fighting there so that the British, Estonians, Americans don't have to fight with Russia. If the war will expand, we will be the first ones to be hit, and we don't want that.
Admitting a new member to NATO has to be agreed unanimously. So the alliance is hoping to placate the Ukrainian president with membership minus, upgraded status alongside NATO, less bureaucracy on the way to joining, and a group of countries, including the UK, the US, France and Germany, giving assurances of ongoing and unwavering support in the meantime.
So how's all that going down in Kyiv? Well, our security correspondent Gordon Carrera is in the Ukrainian capital. I asked him why, given that Ukraine joining NATO was first discussed back in 2008, the issue remained unresolved more than 15 years later.
Ukraine feels like it's been knocking on NATO's door for years now.
And what you heard today was President Zelensky banging on the door, effectively saying, let us in. Because you're right, back in 2008 at the Bucharest summit, there was talk about membership, but without ever a clear commitment of a time frame or what would lead to that membership. So the door was open, but it wasn't clear how Ukraine could walk through it. And that's been their frustration ever since. And today you heard President Zelensky effectively saying, make a commitment. We understand we can't be let in during the war, but let's have a timetable or a clear commitment that at some point in the future it will happen. Now, they didn't get that in the communique. It's clear that what NATO is saying is, well, we've taken away one of the steps that you need to do to join, but it still will depend on allies agreeing and on certain conditions being met. So I think, you know, Ukraine publicly will be careful in what it says. It doesn't want to look ungrateful for the support it is getting from NATO, from allies, including weapons from some of those countries. But at the same time, it knows it's not there yet where it wants to be.
The language, though, absurd was the word attributed to President Zelensky. It sounds like what he has heard today in terms of, yes, you can join, but conditions first, is a long, long way off what he wanted to come out of Vilnius.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting because he used that absurd language on the way to Vilnius. And it was interesting because he issued a tweet as he was heading to Vilnius saying, we're hearing that we won't be given a clear path to membership. That would be absurd. Now, what that a lot of people here in Kyiv took it as was they knew that there were divisions within NATO. They knew that there was still back and forth right up to the last minute about the communique. So I think it was a way of President Zelensky putting some public pressure on NATO countries to give him more of what he wanted. Now, we've had the communique, but we haven't really had, he spoke this evening, but he hasn't really talked in detail yet about his response to that communique. So I think we'll wait and see what the exact language is now that Ukraine uses.
Gordon Carrera reporting there. Washington has condemned Russia for vetoing the extension of a crucial border crossing from Turkey into Syria, which has been a lifeline for aid into opposition-held areas. The US ambassador to the United Nations, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, described the veto in the UN Security Council as an act of utter cruelty. Stefan Dujarric is a spokesperson for the UN Secretary-General.
The Secretary General is disappointed that the Security Council was not able to reach agreement today on extending the authorization of the United Nations cross-border relief operations in Syria. UN cross-border assistance remains a veritable lifeline for millions of people in the northwest of Syria, as humanitarian needs have reached an all-time high since the start of the conflict.
Moscow argues that all aid should be channeled through the Syrian government in Damascus. The land route from Turkey is the only one not under the control of Syrian government forces. Now, Washington has also called on Israel to respect the right of peaceful assembly after Israeli police arrested more than 70 protesters opposed to judicial changes. Thousands of people caused disruption in protests around Israel's main international airport. Hundreds of police were deployed as demonstrators turned Ben-Gurion Airport near Tel Aviv into a sea of blue and white Israeli flags. Protests also took place in other cities across Israel, with mounted police and water cannon used to remove demonstrators blocking main roads. Here's our Jerusalem correspondent, Tom Bateman.
We have just got off a train at Ben-Gurion Airport outside Tel Aviv with thousands of flag-waving protesters. What's extraordinary is this is happening every few minutes. These trains are delivering Israel's unprecedented protests.
Hemmed in by police outside the arrivals terminal, the vast crowd chanted for democracy. At times, there were violent scuffles as security forces pushed protesters aside to make way for arriving passengers and their suitcases. Even the fact the Attorney General permitted the protest here against the express demands of Israel's far-right police minister has added to the highly charged atmosphere. There is deepening polarization over the Israeli government's planned judicial reforms. Mr. Netanyahu, who earlier this year partly backed down, is under renewed pressure to push on with the proposals. He is politically weaker than at any time in his premiership and on trial for corruption amid a growing security crisis over the occupied Palestinian territories. The ultra-religious and extreme nationalists in his coalition see now as their best chance to achieve their long-held desire to rein in the power of Israel's judges, who they see as a liberal bloc to their plans. Most secular Jewish Israelis see the proposals as leading to a nationalist theocracy. The reforms are back on, and the splits within Israeli society over them are growing ever deeper.
Tom Bateman reporting from Israel. Scientists are moving closer to declaring that humans are in a new geological time period, or epoch. From the late Jurassic to the Upper Cretaceous, epochs can span millions of years and are defined by changes to the environment. Now, 11,000 years after the last epoch, geologists say humans have changed the world so much that it's time for a new one, the Anthropocene, or the time of the humans. And they say a lake in Canada could help them define it. Our science editor, Rebecca Morell, has been finding out more.
It's not every day that a new epoch is proposed. We've been living through the last one, the Holocene epoch, for more than 11,000 years. But scientists believe it's now time for the Anthropocene, the age of humans, because humanity's impact is reshaping the planet. These changes are being etched into the geological record, and scientists think the best example of this is recorded in sediments found at the bottom of Crawford Lake in Canada. Visible layers of mud, like tree rings, represent every year of our past, and they capture the fingerprints of human activity, from the byproducts of fossil fuels and industrial pollution to the fallout from nuclear testing. They show the moment the Anthropocene began, which scientists propose is the middle of the last century. Dr. Simon Turner is from University College London.
This change in the whole Earth system has occurred as a result of an enormous amount of human activity. And that human activity in terms of combustion of fossil fuels, population growth, production, these sort of, you know, but what has created the modern world, it's the rapidity and the magnitude of this change that has occurred only very recently, but has really knocked us as a whole planet into this potentially new epoch, this what we describe as the Anthropocene.
It's the first time a new epoch has been proposed by the people living through it. Various geology committees will now vote on whether to adopt the term over the coming months before the Anthropocene epoch is set in stone.
Rebecca Morell. Still to come.
Any material that you can break down to one element only, being carbon, you can make a diamond out of it.
So could Barcelona Football Club make such precious gems from the grass in its stadium?
In 2011, the Fukushima nuclear power plant on the east coast of Japan was struck by a tsunami. It triggered the world's worst nuclear disaster since Chernobyl.
We are in a nuclear emergency!
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of how the disaster unfolded and of those living with its aftermath.
I'll never be able to separate myself from it.
Catch up with the whole series now by searching for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Now, new figures show the scale of the security challenge facing Nigeria's newly installed president, with approximately 800 people killed in attacks just last month. That's according to a report by a security research organisation. President Bola Tinubu promised to make security the top priority for his government. I got more from our correspondent Chris Iwoko in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
These numbers are coming from different attacks in different parts of the country. Basically, aside from the Islamist attacks in the northeast of the country, we also have criminal gangs that have been very active in the northwest. They've been engaged in attacking communities and also kidnapping villagers, mostly for ransom. Again, in the southeast, we have separatist agitations that have also been accused of attacking security agents and communities. And in central Nigeria, we've had running battles between cattle herders and local farmers.
What does this tell us about the success or the lack of success for the country's new president? Because he, like many before him, has promised to tackle corruption, tackle this criminality, and yet we have this number.
exactly how many people are actually feeling here in Nigeria. People are afraid. There was this sense of urgency when he was sworn in, when he promised security would be his top priority. But a month and a half of his administration, the situation hasn't improved. And it seems that either the government, as many people suggest, are still quite low, like the previous administration, or probably they are still at a planning table trying to put their acts together. But whichever way it is, lives are being lost.
I was going to say to you, it's only 6 weeks in, and you've hinted at some people's belief that the president is still essentially planning what to do. But what changes have we seen already under his leadership to try and deal with attacks like these?
The main change we have seen is the appointment of new security chiefs. He changed the chief of defense staff, chief of army staff, the head of the Navy and the Air Force. He also changed the head of police and the national security advisor. So all these are new officials that have come in to sort of support his administration. Now, one would be expecting that there should be some action that would indicate that a new sheriff has come to town.
Well, I was going to say we're seeing a change in personnel, but are you seeing a change in tactics yet?
The change in tactics has not yet manifested, and that's why people are worried here in Nigeria and actually wondering what are the security agencies doing to bring the situation under control.
Chris Iwoko in Abuja. Now, it's a journey tens of thousands take every year, and it's one fraught with peril. They are the migrant crossings from North Africa across the Mediterranean towards Europe. The majority begin in Tunisia or Libya. The BBC's Alice Cuddy was on board a vessel belonging to the aid group SOS Mediterranee. As a rescue mission took place, she met a group of teenagers who'd been risking their lives to try to make it to Europe.
An overcrowded blue rubber boat is approaching, packed with what look like teenage boys. One is wearing a Manchester City football shirt. The boys are in a state of distress. They've been in the boat since the early hours. Things get more tense as the Libyan Coast Guard races onto the scene.
The one is the one, and we have the visitors.
Some of these boys have been pulled back to Libya before. The NGO conducting the rescue, SOS Mediterranee, have had tense run-ins with the Libyan Coast Guard in the past. The team work quickly, pulling the migrants onto a speedboat one by one.
27! 28!
Safely in the rescue vessel, the boys grin at each other. One even pulls out an iPhone to take a selfie.
You will do that after, okay?
The rescue is completed within half an hour, and the boys are now walking on the deck of the rescue ship. The group are mostly from the Gambia and are aged from their mid-teens to their early 20s. They're sharing harrowing stories of their journeys.
I decided to leave the Gambia, you know, to go abroad and earn for a good living for myself and my family. When I was leaving the Gambia, the immigration asked me, you know, of some documents. To be honest, I didn't tell them I was embarking on the Barkway journey. I told them I have a naming ceremony in Mali that I have to attend.
This 18-year-old doesn't want us to use his real name, so I'm calling him Suma. He says that after meeting a smuggler in Mali, he spent months travelling to Libya, and that along the way, he and others were beaten and mistreated.
I was put in the Land Cruiser. We were 35 people in the Land Cruiser. Before it takes off, they take rope and tie our case like this. Our feet will be out like this. But behind you, there will still be some people that will be there inside. It took 35 people, a rope on our case like this, all over the people who were sitting on top of the Land Cruiser. They take a rope and tie us so that it won't be easy to fall down. Some fall, you know, the driver refused to stand, you know. Some will wound and some others have sickness, but the driver there doesn't mind.
He tells me he spent months in Libya, saving up the money to get to Europe. When finally in the rubber boat, he says the migrants couldn't agree on what to do.
I am scared, but not that much. Some were very, very scared because some were asking us to go back forcing. Some were even forcing. We were not talking to each other. It was so hectic. Some will even want to fight.
This was his second attempt at crossing the Med. Others, like this 17-year-old, have tried even more times.
Seven times I have been trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. This is my seventh time.
On some of those journeys, he says people died.
We are about more than 120 or 25, but it's only 94 people who come out the water. Some people who jump on the water, they cannot come close. And the boat was going, they cannot come close. I've just seen my friends dying. I help a lot, but I cannot help all of them.
As the Ocean Viking heads towards Italy, the boys play football on the deck and queue up to wash the clothes they travelled in buckets of soapy water.
When they hold my hands, into the speedboat, I said, now I have entered Europe. That is what comes to my mind straight.
Alice Cuddy reporting from the Mediterranean Sea. The luxury jeweller Bulgari has been forced to apologise after it was criticised in China for seeming to refer to Taiwan as a separate country. It's the latest company to face the risk of a boycott of its products in China, a hugely important market, over what the government there sees as any challenge to its territorial claims. Viv Marsh has this report.
What Bulgari described as a website management error has made it the latest in a string of luxury brands to face the wrath of Chinese social media users. Many voiced support for Beijing's contention that Taiwan is part of China, not a separate country. Users of the Weibo platform spotted that on web pages outside the Chinese mainland, Bulgari had shown China and Taiwan as being in equal and separate categories. Some posters urged Chinese celebrities who are brand ambassadors for Bulgari to sever their links in protest. The Chinese authorities are super sensitive in such cases. In recent years, they've lambasted Versace, Givenchy and Coach for suggesting on websites and merchandise that Taiwan, Hong Kong and Macau were separate entities. Big businesses are wary of hurting the feelings of the Chinese people, as the authorities put it, in case this also seriously hurts their profit margins. But what might appear from outside China to be minuscule demands serve to increase Beijing's pressure on Taiwan and amplify the global discourse power of the Chinese state.
Viv Marsh. Now let's go to Spain. And Barcelona Football Club is branching out into an unlikely industry. It's trying to raise money by making diamonds out of the grass from the pitch in the famous Nou Camp Stadium. The diamonds will be made into bracelets, pins and necklaces. Sam Fenwick spoke to Rob van Burden, a diamond dealer and expert based in Antwerp in Belgium, and asked him, can you really make diamonds out of grass?
Yes, you can. Any material that you can break down to one element only, being carbon, you can make a diamond out of it.
What's the process? How does it work?
Well, first of all, let me clarify a thing or two. So, how are diamonds formed? If Mother Nature had a recipe card, it would say, take carbon atoms, place them about 100 miles down in the Earth's mantle, heat them to at least 2,200 degrees under 27,000 pounds per square inch. Now, set the timer for a billion years.
Okay.
Allow to cool completely before slicing and serving. That's how natural diamonds are made. Now, it's similar to, let's say, the difference between natural and cultured pearls. Mm-hmm. The former occurs by chance, while the latter is aided by humans. So anything that we can break down to one element, being carbon, we can crystallize under great heat and pressure to diamond.
But what about that time? You said it needs to be in the ground for like millions of years. How do we speed that bit up?
Oh, yes, but we can accelerate that process in the laboratory today.
Okay. And so what about the value of these diamonds? Are they as valuable as the ones that you dig out of the ground?
No. And there's well, we always say there's not enough disclosure when it comes to value. So let's say that the retail value of a synthetic or lab-grown diamond, by the way, that's no different than a natural diamond, but it was fabricated yesterday in a Chinese factory or even in a UK factory, because you have factories too. These go retail half the price of a natural diamond. Now, by disclosure, I mean if you were ever to put it up for sale again, then you may get 10% return on your dollar. So when it comes to investment, it's better to buy natural diamonds. And when it comes to having a smaller ecological footprint or a more affordable diamond, then a second choice could be a lab-grown or synthetic diamond.
And you can maybe see why Barcelona are doing this. I can imagine that they put these diamonds in a commemorative box and it would say, you know, this is part of the Nou Camp, which is obviously very iconic, which I think is about to be renovated, isn't it? So they're planning to raise about, or say they're going to raise about $32 million from this. Do you think that's likely?
I think that's very much likely. Not only do they have a stadium with soon over 100,000 seats, but they have, just like Manchester United, they have millions and millions of aficionados or socios, as they call them, fans all over the world. So I think there will be a demand for these goods.
Rob van Beurden, a diamond dealer in Antwerp. Now, it looks like birds are even smarter than we thought when it comes to adopting to modern urban life. A new study by birdwatchers in Europe suggests some species are using materials intended to deter them to actually build their nests. Stephanie Prentice has more.
What makes a bird's nest? Usually the classics like twigs, straw, moss and mud, and other bits of human rubbish as well. But lately, some researchers say that urban crows and magpies have been upping their game, creating fortified nests out of bits of metal. The same metal put on buildings by humans to try and keep birds away. Nests recovered from trees in Rotterdam in the Netherlands and Antwerp in Belgium were found to be constructed almost entirely from long metal spikes, which the birds appear to have removed from buildings. Crows and magpies are known for their cognitive skills, but ornithologists say this is a striking example of them taking anti-bird devices and using them for their own gain. Reflecting on this, one of the researchers said, "We should not deter birds, we should embrace them and live together with them."
Stephanie Prentice. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Robin Brandt. Until the next time, thank you and goodbye.